From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On today's show, we'll bring you a one-hour special with journalist Tom Hartman, who's written two books as part of a new series called Hidden History. First, Tom will discuss the hidden history of guns and the Second Amendment. Then we'll play an extended conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court and what Hartman calls the betrayal of America. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States stands out from much of the rest of the world today in proliferating firearms at a rate that is breathtaking. The vocal demands of a gun-loving minority have led to tens of thousands of deaths a year. High-profile mass shootings, particularly on school campuses, lead to outpourings of thoughts and prayers, but little else. Members of Congress cower in the face of the powerful gun lobby and shrug their shoulders in helplessness. We're told over and over again that the Second Amendment right to bear arms is supreme over our right to safety. Now a new book puts the American obsession with guns into a much-needed political and historical framework. My guest is Tom Hartman. He's a renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times best-selling author of 24 books, including his latest that we are now going to discuss, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Hi, Sonali. It's great to be here with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. So first, I want to ask you about the person that you dedicate your book to, Clark Stinson, a person that you write about that makes this also, I understand, for you, a deeply personal issue. He was your best friend. Tell me a little bit about Clark. What happened to him?
Clark was my best friend through junior high school and high school. And after we got out of school, we went up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan together with a couple of 12-foot teepees that we had bought through the Whole Earth catalog, and spent the whole summer in the middle of the Cherokee. It was a three-day walk back there with an old trapper led us back into the middle of this very, very dense forest in the Upper Peninsula. And we put up our teepees, and we spent 3 or 4 months there doing spiritual practice. We'd be silent 4 days a week, and we brought a bunch of books and 100 pounds of dried fruit and grains, and that's what we ate. And Clark, he and I just discovered so much of life together. From things like that, what I just described, to experimenting with psychedelic drugs and things. He was just an extraordinary guy, and I kind of lost touch with him around the time that I was 18 or 19. And one day, right around Christmas time, he showed up at the house where I was staying, and was just, I hadn't seen him in maybe, I don't know, half a year, a little more than that. And he was just totally depressed. And what had happened was, this was 1969 or 1970, so the Vietnam War was raging, and he had a low draft number, and so he enlisted to avoid getting drafted, hoping that he could get a non-combat job. And he had just finished basic training, and it was the Christmas break before he went out to be deployed, and he was, sure enough, going to be deployed to Vietnam. And we sat and talked together about it for a couple of hours, and I really didn't know what to say. I mean, I listened, I commiserated, but I couldn't, And a couple days later, Clark's wife called me, Colleen, just hysterical, and said that she had just walked into his bedroom and he had bought a gun down the street, apparently, and put it in his mouth and blown the back of his head all over the wall. And that was my first real experience with how ubiquitous and easy guns are to get in the United States and to use. And also, you know, the thing that most Americans don't know, two really startling statistics. One is roughly half of all gun deaths in America are suicides. And when countries like Australia cut back on the number of guns available, well, in the first year after the Port Arthur massacre in 96 and 97, when they pulled hundreds of thousands of guns out of circulation, in that first year afterwards, the suicide rate in Australia dropped by about half, successful suicides. And it has stayed low like that ever since. So guns provide people with that impulse, you know, or that impulsive moment. The opportunity to commit suicide. And then the other statistic that's pretty shocking, which I think reflects how guns and violence have permeated our culture so deeply at such a deep level, is that one out of three of all killings in the United States by strangers, if somebody you know is killed by a stranger, the odds are one out of three that the stranger who killed them was a police officer. Who, of course, are the armed people in our country. And the whole history of policing in the United States, particularly with its roots back in the slave patrols, is also pretty shocking. So
we are in a moment here in the United States, or maybe it's not a moment, a trend that has reached a fever pitch where the right to bear arms has been sort of culturally equated with being American. But it wasn't always that way, was it? What is it about this this moment that we're in where the gun rights activists have managed to capture the narrative about the roles of gun in our society, so much so that a state like Florida, rather than banning guns in schools, has decided to put more guns in schools by passing a law to allow teachers to be armed.
Yeah, which is crazy. I mean, it's just insane. The majority of people in the United States and the majority of both political parties and the politicians in both political parties right up through the 1970s were in favor of reasonable control on guns. The assault weapons ban was very popular when it was passed in the 90s. During the Clinton administration, it didn't get renewed by the Bush administration, tragically. But you know, just this idea that, you know, yeah, guns are part of American history. You know, we use them for hunting, we use them for sport, we use them for self-defense. I mean, this was not controversial. And if you you know, step into the Wayback Machine, the TV Wayback Machine, go on Netflix and watch some of the old cop shows from the 70s and 80s. You know, McMillan and Wife or Columbo, or actually those had very few guns in them. Even the ones that had guns, you know, Rockford Files and things. The guns that they always used were revolvers. They were six-shot pistols where you have to, you know, recock it for every shot. You didn't see semi-automatic weapons. They were considered weapons of war. And it wasn't until Reagan, you know, it was kind of this combination of things. Reagan starting this program where the military was offloading surplus military goods, including guns, to police departments. And then that program got so expanded today that it doesn't even need to go through the military. The police departments can get stuff directly from defense contractors using federal funds. So we've hyper-militarized our police. And at the same time, the NRA in the late 70s was essentially taken over and by the gun manufacturers and converted from a sports shooting organization into a lobbying organization on behalf of the gun manufacturers. And you know, some of the more bizarre theories about the history of guns in the United States, for example, a theory that the founders wanted the Second Amendment so that we could protect ourselves if the government ever became tyrannical. You know, that was never a conversation You will not find a single word of that in James Madison's notes on the Constitution. You won't find a single word about trying to use guns to put down a repressive government in any of the ratifying debates, when the Constitution was being considered. It was literally not part of the conversation when the Second Amendment itself was being debated and considered. And there is literally no time in American history where that argument was made until the mid-70s, when a teenage boy wrote an op-ed for The Rifleman, which was the NRA's magazine, suggesting that this is why the founders wrote the Second Amendment. And it's been adopted as an article of faith by these hardcore right-wingers in the militia movement, to the point that, whenever I discuss guns on my program, every fourth or fifth call is some variation on that. Well, we've got to have the guns to keep the overpowering government. And I'm like, really? You think with your AR-15, you're going to take on a Black Hawk helicopter? It's silly. So what we've seen is a complete transition of the debate. You combine that with the Heller decision, where Scalia, just lied and twisted facts and things to come up with this individual right to own guns, again, which was never asserted during the founding era. The whole gun dynamic in the United States since the early 1980s has become radically different from what it was during the entire rest of the history of the United States. I mean, the Wild West, Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, he required you, if you came into town with a gun, to check in at the police station and leave it on a special wall that they had with pegs on it, and they'd give you a claim check, and you couldn't carry your gun in town. When you wanted to leave town, you'd come back and get your claim check. That was it.
So let's go a little bit into that history that you describe in your book that just isn't discussed very much today. And one of the most interesting aspects of it is that you point out that while slavery was still an institution, it was essentially those who claimed ownership over enslaved people who owned the majority of guns, and that after slavery ended, you had gun ownership became very popular among the Klansmen. What is the history of, how intertwined is the history of racism and slavery with that of gun ownership in America?
Well, they're very, very tied together. And the reason why is because the militia that is referred to in the Second Amendment took two forms, and they were quite different in the North and the South. The militia in the North was basically the state militias, what we call the National Guard now. And the idea was that should the country ever be invaded, each state would pull up a militia. They would keep everybody, sort of like they do in Switzerland, or they have done in Switzerland for hundreds of years. There's literally no standing army. A number of the founders were very, very worried about a standing army. They had seen throughout European history that over and over and over again, standing armies during times of peace were what overthrew governments. And so the original impetus for the Second Amendment came from a letter from Jefferson to Madison in December of 1787, right after the first draft of the Constitution was written, in which Jefferson said that he would fight the Constitution if Madison did not include a provision in it that prevented there being a standing army during time of peace. And Madison actually put that in the Constitution. It's Article 1, Section 8. It says that the Congress cannot appropriate any money at all for more than 2 years for the army. The army ceases to exist every 2 years officially, and has from the founding of the Republic. It's not true of the Navy, but it is true of the army. But then Jefferson wanted even more, and so they pushed that to an amendment as well, to the Second Amendment. But in the South, four of the Southern states, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, had slave patrols. And then at the time of the founding, eventually they did in Florida as well, in Alabama and Mississippi. And the slave patrols were basically the local militia. Every man between the ages of 17 and 47 who did not have a, quote, non-critical occupation, which basically excluded doctors, lawyers, and legislators, had to report every month for 1 day of service, traveling around the region looking for runaway slaves. and had to do a week or two of service every year, learning how to use the weapons. And I mean, if you're going to impose an absolute military dictatorship, a police state, which is what the institution of slavery was, it was a police state. If you're going to impose a police state on people and keep them down, particularly in states like Georgia and Virginia, where you had, particularly Georgia and South Carolina, where you had as much as half of the population being enslaved people, then you had to use a hell of a lot of guns, and you had to be good at those guns, and you had to be very, very knowledgeable about where they were and how they were used. So guns were, you know, used in two big ways at the beginning of the United States. Number one, we committed the largest genocide in the history of the world. Between 50 and 100 million Native Americans were killed on this continent by Europeans. Probably about half of them, there's a big debate, you know, between a third and two-thirds died from disease, and the balance died typically at the end of a gun barrel. And then as the institution of slavery took hold, slavery, of course, was enforced with guns. And again, to the Second Amendment, the fascinating part of it is, you know, when the Second Amendment was proposed in the Virginia Ratifying Convention, Patrick Henry was the largest slaveholder in the state, and the original draft of the Second Amendment said, for the protection of a free nation, right, or the security of a free nation. In other words, this was all about, again, the militias rather than having a standing army. Patrick Henry got up and gave this speech in which he went nuts. He said, wait a minute. He said, in fact, this is an early draft, that standing armies in times of peace are dangerous to liberty and therefore ought to be avoided as far as the circumstances and protections of the community will admit. In all cases, the military shall be under strict subordination to the civil power. But then, you know, Patrick Henry got up and gave this speech about it. He said, let me call your attention to that part of the proposed Constitution, is Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing them. By this, sir, you see that their control over our last and best defense, that's the slave patrol in Virginia, is unlimited. If they neglect or refuse to discipline or arm our militia will become useless. The states can do neither. This power is being exclusively given to Congress. The power of appointing officers over men not disciplined or armed is ridiculous. So this, and he goes on, and he and George Mason basically said, change the language of the Second Amendment from for the protection of a free nation to the protection of a free state, so that Virginia can control their slave patrols. Because if a anti-slavery president ever got into the White House, they have the power to call up all the state militias, and they could call up the state, you know, the slave patrol in Virginia, specifically in this case, and move them out of state. And you would have, you know, your police state would fall apart, and you'd have slave uprisings, and it would be the end of peace and harmony, was the phrase that Patrick Henry used. And it's ironic. He's famous for saying, give me liberty or give me death, but he was the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia. And Madison called him paranoid, said, what, you're paranoid? And literally. And Patrick Henry was like, no, I'm not. And so Madison changed the Second Amendment to conform with what Patrick Henry wanted.
I want to fast forward to today and pick up on what you were saying earlier, and also what you write in your book, which is connecting the issue of gun proliferation with gun deaths at the hands of police. We don't hear that connection being made often enough in mainstream American society. Politicians on both sides of the aisle may decry the results of gun violence. The Democrats might even go as far as to talk about gun control, but they don't necessarily link police violence and police killing to the broader issue of gun violence in America. And I'm wondering why you think that is. Does that have something to do with these historical roots you were just discussing?
I'm not sure. I know that there is a deep authoritarian strain in American society, culture, and history. We celebrate authoritarian people in positions in many cases, you know, now in the airport, soldiers get to board the plane before, you know, pretty much anybody else. With regard to our police, it's really weird. I'd say that this has particularly taken place since the 1950s with the advent of television. And I think some of it has to do with all the cop shows that we've had on, you know, makes for great entertainment, figuring out who killed somebody, that kind of thing. But it's pretty horrifying. I mean, I had, Louise and I both actually had surgery some years ago. So we were, you know, recovering, laying in bed, binge watching Netflix. And we watched the modern version of Hawaii Five-0, which we'd watched as kids, the old version. And they were literally like shooting guns into the knees of people that they were holding in the basement of the Hawaii Police Department to interrogate as part of their interrogation. I mean, brutalizing people. And I think that this, and this spread, you know, I've seen this in cop show after cop show after cop show, where they with a wink and a nod, they break the law in very often in very brutal ways. And I think that a lot of police officers take that as training, you know, as the norm. And I think that that just had been going and getting more and more intense, and particularly with Reagan, you know, super arming our police and turning them into military forces in the 80s and 90s, and then, you know, more and more cop shows through the 2000s. And it really wasn't until this disruptive technology of everybody carrying a camera in their cell phone came along that suddenly we started to see the consequences of this hyper-empowerment and hyper-militarization and arming of police officers in the United States. You know, we used to, Americans always thought it was kind of eccentric that in Great Britain, the cops didn't carry guns, and in Canada, you know, you couldn't carry a gun until you'd been a police officer for a certain number of years. We thought that was quaint. But now that we're seeing all these, you know, poorly trained, poorly paid, and frankly, shouldn't even be police people, murdering largely unarmed black men, I think America is starting to wake up to this, which is a good thing.
And so let's talk about what we're seeing today. We're a very sort of a tinderbox of a situation where you have ongoing, continued, you know, ongoing gun proliferation, a president who has embraced the NRA as a very critical part of his base, and his whipping up of white supremacy and unleashing of white nationalism among a largely armed base of support that, you know, if you kind of follow that trajectory to an extreme place, we could see maybe armed rebellion from Trump supporters if he loses election 2020. It's not out of the realm of possibility. Do you fear that what we have today is a toxic, you know, storm, a perfect storm of potentially explosive violence?
Yes, I do. I am concerned about that. I think the violent explosion is less likely than just, you know, the way I think this is likely to play out is less like, you know, say the riots in the 60s and 70s where people were just like, enough already, and probably more like the way that authoritarianism has risen in other countries. We saw this in Hungary with the rise of Viktor Orban. We saw it in Turkey with the rise of Erdogan. Most Americans are unaware of it, though. What they remember is the brown shirts in Germany in the 30s, in the early 30s, and the black shirts in Italy. These were both entirely volunteer groups. Nobody was paid. They did not have an official affiliation with the government, but they came out in support of the rise of Hitler and Mussolini. And mostly what they did was random acts of violence. They'd go around and, you know, smash store windows or beat up people who didn't look like them, you know, who they were opposed to. And frankly, and guns were not as widespread back then there, but you know, this thuggery is, like I said, you know, we've seen this also now in Hungary and we see it in Russia, many of these authoritarian countries, the Philippines. And that's my biggest concern, although those thugs are well armed, so it could be a little more deadly here, but that's frankly what I'm expecting given the direction things are going. I think that an actual Turner Diaries kind of armed rebellion is pretty unlikely, although that's what all the right wingers want.
So I just want to mention to our audience that we're talking about your new book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, and they can actually check out where you're going to be speaking about that book on your website at tomhartmann.com, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. And there's an event in Los Angeles where I'm based and where our home station is based as well, that we'll put information about on our website. But let's also turn then to this issue of how are those politicians, because we want political change, we want guns in this country to stop being so prevalent and dangerous in our lives. We absolutely need political change, but the politicians either ignore the activism of survivors of gun violence or claim that they just can't stand up to the NRA, to the gun rights folks. There are some cracks, however, it seems, in the facade, at least of the NRA, as their recent annual conference showed. They are in a battle with their major law, with their major PR firm. There's a sense that they're losing money and may have to go bankrupt. But I don't know if that's being too optimistic. You lay out some pretty direct solutions in your book, namely what other countries have carried out that shows that gun control really can work quite easily, right?
Yeah, there's a variety of ways. With regard to the NRA, I think that their days are limited. You know, in 1996, the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. was the tobacco lobby. By 2000, they were insignificant because of a series of lawsuits exposed how corrupt the tobacco institute, the tobacco lobby rather, was, and the tobacco companies. And I think the same kind of unmasking has happened with regard to the NRA in the last year. People are figuring out, and particularly people who are NRA members, who throughout the Obama presidency were receiving on a weekly basis or on a regular basis emails and hysteria about how, you know, that black guy in the White House is going to take away your guns. And in fact, I opened the book with a story of going to a shooting range, and the guy who was selling me the ammunition went off on a rant about that black guy in the White House, although he used far more obscene language. So, you know, I see that going down. In terms of what's being done in other countries, in Europe, so guns have been developed now that will not fire unless they recognize your fingerprint, or unless they recognize your grip, or unless you're wearing a watch or a piece of jewelry that has a chip in it that the gun recognizes. These safe guns, this is brilliant technology that has been aggressively fought in the United States. One of the proposals I have in the book is kind of an American solution, but I think it's a solid one, and it's what, you know, it's largely what Australia has ended up with, except for the third part, the insurance part. And that is that in the 19-teens, when cars were so ubiquitous that they were starting to kill people in large numbers, you know, by accident, we came up with a three-part solution in addition to stop signs and things and standardizing the rules of the road. The first one was every car from the time it's manufactured until the time it's destroyed has to have a registration number, and that registration number annually gets renewed and attached to an individual human being. So you can have a chain of custody and responsibility, number one. Number two, you have to prove that you know how to drive. So you have to prove proficiency and knowledge of the laws. And number three, you have to have liability insurance. If we did the same thing for guns, I think that that would be just a tremendous thing. And it's so common sense. Even people who own guns and are really into guns, by and large, won't rebut this. I mean, for that matter, Republicans, you can sell this to them by saying, hey, the insurance part is the ultimate free market solution. If somebody goes to an insurance company and tries to get the liability insurance for their gun, which might normally be $100 a year, but the insurance company looks into their record and discovers they've got a domestic violence conviction, suddenly that insurance is going to be $20,000 a year, or maybe they won't even write a policy, and so they can't get a gun. So, you know, there's way, and I think it's crazy that, you know, if the kids at Sandy Hook or Stoneman Douglas High School had been killed by a crazed drunk driver, maliciously or accidentally, it wouldn't matter. GEICO would be writing million-dollar checks to all those families. But because they were killed by guns, they got nothing. They don't even have burial expenses. I mean, it's just wrong. So that's one of the simple solutions.
What about the fact that we also get the sense that there is this group of Americans that will never change its mind about guns? I'm wondering what you've found through your research and writing about how we change culture among those Second Amendment rights activists. Or is that population's influence overblown, and that actually those gun rights people are more reasonable than we're led to believe, and it's more the NRA and the gun manufacturers kind of manufacturing their consent?
Yeah, I grew up in Michigan in a lower middle class blue collar neighborhood. My dad worked in a tool and die shop. Most of my friends worked at General Motors or Fisher Body. And I'd say probably four-fifths of the people that I grew up with had guns. Probably half of them went hunting every year. It was just a ritual in Michigan. And they weren't crazies. I've known a few of the quote crazies, people who have, you know, 30, 40, 50 guns. And I think that is a very, very tiny minority of the gun owning population. And I think that there is probably an associated mental illness with that. It's like a hoarding complex sort of thing. There's some deep insecurity or fear that's driving them. But I really think that that's a super minority.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I want to wish you good luck with your book and your book tour.
Thank you, Sonali. And thanks for having me on your program. It's a real honor.
Thank you. My guest has been Tom Hartmann, renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author of 24 books, including his newest, which we've just been discussing, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. You can find out more about his work, his show, his book, and his book tour at tomhartmann.com. That's TOMHARTMANN. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe for our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court has touched just about every aspect of Americans' lives. Right now, justices are hearing arguments and cases concerning the rights of LGBTQ Americans to have a discrimination-free workplace. Although the court is meant to uphold the rights of individuals under the Constitution, historically the body has, on numerous occasions, violated its own principles. In recent years, the court's justices have taken it upon themselves to empower corporations to such an extent that our entire political system has been perverted to preserve and expand the power of corporate profiteers at the expense of people and the planet. How did we get here? And what can be done about it? Joining me to answer that question is Tom Hartmann, renowned progressive radio talk show host, New York Times bestselling author of 24 books, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. And he joins me to discuss his latest book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Sonali. It's great to be here with you.
So we had talked to you last time about your book about the Second Amendment. Here you are writing a history about the Supreme Court. But for those who don't really pay attention to the details of the role that the court plays in our political system, can you give us that brief history lesson about what it was that the Constitution's framers intended in the role, in seeing the role of this court with nine justices making these very important decisions about our lives?
Yeah. Well, the ultimate issue is, you know, do we want a constitutional monarchy, which is essentially what we have with the Supreme Court exercising judicial review as rigorously as it does, or do we want a constitutional democracy, a democratic republic? The founders envisioned the Supreme Court as having two basic purposes. The first was to be the primary court where disputes between the states and between the federal government and the states would be adjudicated, and among other United States and other countries and some maritime law. And then, but the principal job of the court, and probably 95%, 99% of what the court does, is being the court of last appeals. Somebody sues somebody else and they win, and then that person appeals it, and then they win, and then the other person appeals it, and it goes back and forth. There's got to be a place where the buck stops, and that's the Supreme Court. But starting in 1803, the court took onto itself, over the loud objections of President Jefferson at the time, the right to not only decide who wins and loses a case, but also to decide whether the laws passed by Congress and signed by the president match the court's understanding of the Constitution. And that's when, you know, according to Jefferson and many of the founders and framers, that was when we slid out of being a democratic republic and into being a constitutional monarchy. It so burned the fingers of the court, of John Marshall, the Chief Justice, the blowback to that case, that Marbury versus Madison case, that he never did it again, and he was on the bench longer than any other Chief Justice. The second time was Dred Scott in 1856, when Chief Justice Roger Twaney thought he would solve once and for all the slavery problem. So basically, the court acted as the court of final appeals throughout the first 80 or 90 or 100 years of American history. But in the 1880s, as at least three of the justices on the court were being bribed by Jay Gould and the railroad billionaires, the court started striking down laws and changing laws and reinterpreting laws according to what they said the Constitution meant. And now that's almost all that the court does. It's really not the way it was envisioned.
Now, you mentioned judicial review. What exactly is that?
Judicial review is the ability of a court to say, we are going to look at this law and determine whether it comports with the Constitution or not. The rationale for that, that John Marshall laid out in the 1803 Marbury case, was that the Constitution itself says that it is the supreme law of the land. So it is the law. And somebody has to decide what the Constitution means, you know, if somebody passes a law that's unconstitutional. But, you know, this is how the court was sold. This is from Federalist Number 81 by Alexander Hamilton. There is not a syllable in the Constitution under consideration which directly empowers the national courts to construe the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution, or which gives them any greater latitude in this respect than may be claimed by the courts of every state. So, you know, it was not the way the court was sold. And it's something that we really need to have a conversation about in this country. People say, for example, well, what if Congress passed a law saying that if you criticize the president, you go to jail? It's an obvious violation of the First Amendment. And my response is, Congress did pass that law in 1798, the Alien Sedition Act. It was the break between President Adams and Vice President Jefferson. They didn't talk to each other for 2 years after that. And the first thing Adams did was throw Ben Franklin's grandson in jail for calling him balding and querulous, you know, in his paper, The Aurora. But that was solved not by the Supreme Court. That was solved by the election of 1800. And that was what Jefferson said when George Mason sent him a letter saying, well, if the Supreme Court doesn't have the power to decide what the Constitution says, who does? And Jefferson said, the people themselves. This is why Congress is, why the House of Representatives, which is where all power begins, whether it's taxing, spending, or war, why the House of Representatives is entirely, 100% reelected every 2 years.
Hmm. So currently we are essentially told that the Supreme Court is part of that system of checks and balances between the various branches of government. And when the congressional branch or the executive branch gets too powerful or abuses its power too much, the Supreme Court is there to step in. Is that a myth?
No, if there was a dispute between those two branches, as we're starting to see right now in this impeachment hearing, then the court plays a role in that dispute. They're an arbiter in that dispute. That's a different thing from judicial review, where the court, you know, literally strikes down laws or even manufactures laws, writes laws. you know, comes up with opinions that where they have invented doctrines. So, you know, what the court has, what we have now, I remember after Obamacare was passed, everybody was like holding their breath, you know, is the court going to strike it down? The founders and framers, I think, would be rolling over in their graves at something like that. What we have now is a constitutional monarchy where the monarchs are 9 unelected people with lifetime positions on the Supreme Court who have final say over literally everything. And we really need to have a conversation in this country about whether that's what we want.
So let's talk about how it is that the role that the court has played in a very critical aspect of our American political system, which is that today we have a situation where corporations are considered people and money is considered free speech, a concept that has ended up, you know, allowing the wealthy to foist their views, their policies, their politics on the entire country. What role did the Supreme Court play in making that happen?
Well, these are both examples of judicial review. In the case of corporations becoming persons, the court actually didn't rule in 1886 in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad that corporations are persons. But John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the court, wrote it into the headnotes that Morrison Remick Waite, the Chief Justice, had said that in the court. But the court started referring to that headnote, which has no legal status. And as soon as they quoted it, suddenly it did have legal status. So that's where we got that from, was, you know, the court, quote, interpreting the 14th Amendment, part of the Constitution. And then in 1976, for the first time in the history of the United States, money had always been viewed as a commodity that could be regulated. In fact, you could make an argument that most of the Constitution is about property rights, unless the regulation of money in its various forms or things that can be bought with money. But in 1976, in the Buckley versus Vallejo case, heavily influenced by Lewis Powell, who'd just been on the court for 5 years at that point, the author of the Powell memo, the court ruled that if a billionaire wants to own a politician or change public opinion, you know, with regard to things like ballot initiatives, that's just fine. That's considered free speech. Money is speech. And then they doubled down on that 2 years later in the First National Bank versus Frank Bilotti decision, where they said that this logic extends to corporations as well. And then they tripled down on it in 2010, in October of 2010, with the Citizens United decision. No legislature of any state and no federal legislature has ever, ever said money is speech and corporations are people. In fact, they have repeatedly said the opposite. No president or candidate for president has ever said that, other than Mitt Romney, and who knows how serious, well, whatever, but has, you know, no sitting president has ever said that the corporations are people and money is speech. This was entirely invented by the Supreme Court, and it points out the danger of having essentially the Supreme Court as the monarchs in a constitutional monarchy rather than having a true democracy.
And so you mentioned very briefly Lewis Powell and the Powell memo. This is something that is the basis of so much of the sort of corporate oligarchy that we're seeing played out in the country today, the supremacy of quote unquote free enterprise. And didn't his memo essentially give wind to the Koch brothers and their stranglehold over American politics?
Yes. During the early years of the Industrial Revolution, the 1870s, 80s, 90s, as the steel oligarchs and the oil oligarchs and the rail oligarchs rose up, they began to politicize the court and Congress, for that matter. And there was a significant backlash to that, and that was Teddy Roosevelt's administration. And, you know, the trust busters and the passage of the Tillman Act in 1907 that made it a federal felony for a corporation to give money to politicians for federal office. And so basically from that era, from the 1900s, right up until the 1960s and 70s, corporations, you know, they'd gotten their fingers burned and they just stayed out of politics. And in 1971, Lewis Powell wrote this memo in which he pointed out that Ralph Nader and Rachel Carson, and he named them in the memo, had kicked off a consumer movement and an environmental movement, respectively, that were placing the profits of corporations at risk and that big corporations and wealthy individuals needed to join forces and take over our courts, take over our legislatures, take over our states, take over our schools, take over our colleges, take over our media. And that led to the creation of the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and the Competitive Enterprise Institute and all these other right-wing organizations. It led to the rise of the right-wing media barons. And of course, it led to the Federalist Society, which is right now actively packing our federal court system. Of course, Powell being on the court brought us Buckley. And in fact, Lewis Powell authored the decision 2 years later in First National Bank versus Bilotti.
In your book, you point out that there are so many issues that majorities of Americans support, such as taxing the ultra wealthy, such as reproductive rights for women, et cetera. And yet we don't have some of these hugely popular policies in place. How much of a role has the Supreme Court played in essentially preventing that democratic exercise of power?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge, because in 76 and 78, by saying that billionaires and corporations can own politicians on a virtually unlimited basis, and then in 2010 with Citizens United making it practical, you know, for all practical purposes, an unlimited basis, and then the McCutcheon decision 3 years later, which originally there was a limit to the number of politicians an individual billionaire could own. And they said, no, there's not a limit. It's not 130 like it used to be. It's whatever you want. What these decisions have done is they have taken the entire political process out of the hands of voters and average Americans and put them into the hands of a small group of elite billionaires and big corporations. Gillens and Page at Columbia University did a study that was published back in, I think, 2015, maybe 2014, in which they found that nowadays, unlike the 1950s, in the 1950s and 60s and 1970s, and look at the accomplishments of the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson, for example, creating Medicare and Medicaid and all these other things. During that era, what was generally politically popular among the majority of people was what got made into law. But now, today, the probabilities of what the bottom 90% of Americans economically want being made into law is absolutely equivalent to random chance. It's the equivalent of noise, just mathematical noise in the system. Whereas the desires of the top 5% are frequently more, well over half of the time, and when you get into the top 1%, well over 2/3 of the time enacted into law. So we have a system that has been badly corrupted by money, and that was brought to you exclusively by the Supreme Court. In fact, when they did that in Buckley in 76, they struck down several of the laws that just the year before had been passed by Congress in the wake of the Nixon bribery scandals to get money out of politics, and clean the whole thing up.
So today we have a court that is deeply polarized and, really is extremely partisan. We've seen so much, depending upon who is nominating a Supreme Court justice to the court, just those decisions are deeply political and deeply partisan. Is that new? Is that a new trend in the Supreme Court? Or has the Supreme Court essentially always been and nominating justices, has that practice always been a partisan issue depending upon the political party allegiance of the president making the nominations?
It has, to a certain extent, throughout its history, been a political agency. The times have been different and the issues have been different, but the court from its founding has been basically an instrument that protected wealth and privilege, aggressively protected wealth and privilege, and continues to be so. And this is where I think we need to democratize the court. And there's a number of ways to deal with this court becoming so ideological and so, hardcore right-wing crazed as a result of Mitch McConnell basically violating his oath of office and not respecting the Constitution, refusing to allow Obama's nominees on the court for several years, including Merrick Garland. And we could look at what Franklin Roosevelt nearly did in 37, court packing, what actually was done by Congress when Andrew Johnson became president. They cut the size of the court from 10 people down to 6 so that Andrew Johnson would not be able to put anybody on the court. And then right after Johnson got out of office and U.S. Grant was president, they raised it back up to 9, which is where it is now. That could be done. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that Congress can define exceptions to things that the court can rule on. So it is possible that Congress could pass a law saying money is no longer speech and corporations are no longer persons. It's called court stripping or judicial court stripping generally, and it's happened in states a few times. There has been legislation that has had provisions saying that the Supreme Court may not review the laws, but they've been non-controversial laws. If that were to happen, what I just described, it would create a constitutional crisis. I mean, it would be open war between the Congress and the Supreme Court. But Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution is quite explicit. The Supreme Court shall operate under exceptions and regulations defined by Congress. That's exactly what it says, and I can't see how it can be interpreted to mean anything else.
Right now, we have a situation where the Supreme Court may play a role in an impeachment inquiry. We have an impeachment inquiry underway where the House of Representatives is where such inquiries or articles begin. And then if it does pass the House, it goes to the Senate for a trial presided over by the Chief Justice of that court, in this case, John Roberts. What do you hope, given where the court is today, the role that the court will play in what is definitely going to be a history-making chapter in America?
Yeah, assuming that it gets to the Senate and that Mitch McConnell allows there to be a trial, which I think are both looking like better than 50% right now. John Roberts was William Rehnquist's clerk during the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So he's familiar with the process. And Rehnquist did a pretty good job of staying out of the way, basically just being the judge. Where it's going to get interesting, and this did not happen in the case of the Clinton impeachment, and it never got to the Senate, so there wasn't a discussion about it with the Nixon impeachment hearings. And this didn't happen with the impeachment of Andrew Johnson either. What's going to be interesting is if the Trump administration continues to stonewall Congress. They're doing it right now to the House of Representatives. The House may not have, at the end of the day, the power to force them to produce witnesses or papers or whatever, even under subpoena and even with contempt citations. But when it gets to the Senate, that's an actual trial. And in a trial, you can be ordered to produce evidence, and you may not refuse that order. And that's going to be a real crisis for John Roberts if the Trump administration continues to stonewall on all this stuff.
Now, I want to look a little bit more broadly around the Supreme Court and especially a really important issue right about in your book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, which is that while we are involved in the political circus that is playing out in Washington, D.C., the planet, or I should say the species, our species, is in an existential crisis. We are seeing the warming of the planet in a very, very serious way. And you point out in your book, of course, that because corporations have used the Citizens United decision to flood our system with money, it essentially, we are beholden, our system is beholden to fossil fuel interests. How critically important is the Supreme Court when it comes to the issue of climate change? There are cases right now before the Supreme Court on the climate, right?
Well, and there's one particularly big case, the Giuliani case, which is working its way in the direction of the Supreme Court. I believe it's still before the Ninth Circuit right now. And the problem that we have, Sonali, is that at the time that the Constitution was written in 1787, the hot new things that, you know, had just kind of come about in the last arguably 200 years prior to that, from, you know, the 1630s when Thomas Hobbes wrote Leviathan, to the 1680s when John Locke wrote Second Treatise on Government. The hot new things were human rights, which we saw built into the Bill of Rights in our Constitution, and property rights, which is probably 80% of the Constitution. And the idea that individual commoners, or at least men, at least white men, could own property was a relatively new thing, you know, after 1,000 years of feudal history in Europe, or more than that even. So the Constitution speaks eloquently to those two issues. But the idea that the environment was important or even should have rights, you know, living things other than human beings should have rights, or even systems, living systems, rivers and air and things like that should have rights, was pretty much unimaginable at that time. I mean, the cities would dump their waste into rivers and it just seemed to vanish. It seemed like the world was limitless. The resources were limitless. And now we're confronted with a planet that is overcrowded by people, overpoisoned by the products of us. We're consuming more than 50% of the world's fresh water. We're consuming more than 50% of the world's photosynthesis, the products of photosynthesis, leaving all these other species to compete for the dregs at the same time that we're poisoning them. And there's not really any place in the Constitution that addresses this. It really needs to be done at the level of a legislature. Although in a constitutional monarchy, I suppose the monarchs could decide something. They could literally, like they created out of thin air the doctrine of corporate personhood, the Supreme Court did, or they created out of thin air the doctrine that money is the same thing as free speech in the First Amendment. They could create a doctrine, I suppose, that nature has rights. I'd frankly rather see it be done legislatively, though.
Right. And of course, if they were to do that, they would be betraying their allegiance to corporate America, which unfortunately is highly unlikely. Finally, Tom, you've written two hidden history books now, the first one on the Second Amendment, this one on the Supreme Court. What's next? Are you going to continue the series?
Yes, there's one coming out in the spring. It's the hidden history of the war on voting, who stole your vote and how to get it back. That's already available for pre-order and it's out there. It will be shipping in March of next year. And then the one that will be coming out next fall, which I'm still writing, I've got a deadline the end of this month here to finish it, we don't have a fully formed title, but it's going to be some variation on the hidden history of monopoly and how monopoly has destroyed both capitalism and democracy.
Wow. Well, looking forward to it. Tom, such a pleasure to have you on. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Hope to have you back with your next books.
Thank you, Sonali. It's great being on your program. Thank you so much.
Tom Hartmann is a renowned progressive radio talk show host, a New York Times best-selling author of 24 books, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. And we've been discussing his latest book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
K-Boo at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month we'll screen the documentary Time to Choose on Thursday, January 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Coal contributes to 4 out of the 5 leading causes of death in the United States.
There was actually 6 neighbors who had brain tumors in about a 10-house span.
Again, that's the documentary Time to Choose on Thursday, January 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Join us on Tuesday, January 21st for Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years. A day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy and surveillance, policing, immigration, labor rights, confronting white nationalism, the environment, and much more. Again, that's Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years on Tuesday, January 21st from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
The Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center wouldn't exist without the local folks who volunteer their time to help the homeless. In episode 4 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast, we meet Tiana, Pete, and John to learn what they do, why they volunteer, and what they have learned about the homeless and themselves as a result. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 7:01 p.m. and now Hard Knock Radio.